In September of 1950, Oliver Brown walked his young daughter to her neighborhood school in Topeka, Kansas. When he tried to enroll Linda in the all-white school, she was denied a spot because she was black. The rejection set in motion one of the most famous court cases in our history. We're talking about the status of integration today in public schools here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the 1954 Supreme Court decision, it struck down the separate but equal doctrine. Across the country, school boards and states tried various workarounds to evade the desegregation orders. Recall the standoff at Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas when a group of black high school students, later called the Little Rock Nine, were prevented from entering the building by the National Guard. Here is Ernest Green describing the first day he and eight other African Americans attempted to attend Central High School in Little Rock.
The Arkansas National Guard physically crossed their rifles. They allow the white students to enter and bar us physically from entering Central High School.
Alexander Nazarian is a senior writer at Newsweek, where he covers national affairs. His recent piece is titled, School Segregation in America is as Bad Today as It Was in the 1960s. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start this conversation by hearing just a bit from Linda Brown, who passed away this week. Here she is talking about her father, Oliver Brown, who was the force behind this lawsuit.
My father believed very much in right, and he felt that it was wrong for black people to have to accept second-class citizenship, and that meant being segregated in their schools, when in fact there were schools right in their neighborhood that they could attend, and they had to go clear across town to attend an all-black school.
So, Alexander, give us some background on how this case became such a force in setting the framework for desegregation, and help us carry it then to where we're at today.
Well, so Brown v. Board is an answer. It's a rebuke of Plessy v. Ferguson, with the 1896 Supreme Court case that had, in fact, sanctioned separate but equal institutions. It was the case of a mixed race gentleman who had refused to sit in an all black rail car while passing through Louisiana. I think it was Louisiana. So Brown v. Board says that's not constitutional because of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And it also says, and it uses sociology to argue, that the harm of segregation is so profound that we can't sanction it as a society. And that was a new tactic for the Supreme Court, which was now presided over by Earl Warren, right, who was seen as this, who was later regarded, or was regarded as this great liberal, right? And one of the things he did is use, for example, Kenneth Clark's doll study, which showed that children of color interiorized their inferiority at a very early age. And he cited that in other studies that, and said, we can't allow this to continue. So it wasn't just looking at the Constitution or case law. It was also looking at, you know, social science to argue that integration was harmful, not just unconstitutional, which they successfully argued that it was. But it was a legal argument bolstered by social science, and that was new for the Supreme Court.
So how did schools react when the Supreme Court handed down Brown versus Board?
Well, sometimes they didn't, because remember, although Brown v. Board said that segregation was unconstitutional, it didn't. It's a 14-page ruling that doesn't spell out how integration is to take place, and there's a ruling called Brown, too, that says that integration is supposed to take place with all deliberate speed. But what does that mean? No, and in fact, nobody quite knew. So while there were attempts at integration in the 1950s, you alluded to Little Rock, and there were, of course, others, most of those were quite fraught, and they were they weren't successful in the way that the court obviously intended, because there wasn't it wasn't until Lyndon Johnson comes into office that there's a real effort to enforce that there's a Civil Rights Act, and there's a genuine effort by the federal government to to enforce integration. And then in the 1960s, we see court orders of sort of forcing, mandating that districts integrate. And from the 60s until the 1980s, we do in fact start to see integration take place. And then since then, we've seen a rollback of integration because many of those orders have been lifted, although there are other reasons as well.
We're talking about school integration. Alexander Nazarian is a senior writer at Newsweek, where he covers national affairs. Talking about Brown versus Board of Education, where American public schools are today. 800-642-1234. Do you remember the Brown versus Board of Education decision? How did you react to it? How did the people around you react? What are your thoughts on racial segregation today, both in schools and in other areas of society? Did this 1954 ruling make a difference to you? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. So, Alexander, Linda Brown was actually involved in two Brown versus Board lawsuits. There was the original, more famous one when she was a child, but then another one 25 years later when she and other plaintiffs sued the school district for not implementing the original Brown decision. Is that right?
That's right. And you know, she was an education activist and speaker throughout her life, and you know, she did call the legacy, she did, I think, at one point call it a hassle, but also an honor, the sort of being identified her entire life with this case. But she also recognized her, she actually, the school, the sort of segregated school that she was made to attend was actually, I think, a quite good school, but that wasn't the point, right? The point was that it was a separate school. And I think she recognized that that injustice of having to walk through a rail yard and then go get on a bus just so that she, just because the whites in the nearby school didn't want her there, that injustice was replicated for millions of children across the country. And whether she wanted to or not, she embodied for her life this quite poignantly, this injustice, and as you said, its continuation really until our time. And so, although of course we don't have segregated schools today legally, I would say almost anybody who studies public education or demographics would say that we do still have, our schools are certainly not integrated to any, to a way that would satisfy anyone who witnessed the 1954 decision and thought, well, finally, this is about to end.
Well, Brown versus Board only applied to states where school segregation was written into the law. How did that impact how integration happened in the South versus the North?
Well, in some ways, it focused, by focusing on the South, it removed pressure from the North to deal with its own de facto segregation. So Northern states could and did argue that because they hadn't fostered segregation through Jim Crow laws, they had nothing to address. Mm. Now, of course, that was disingenuous, and I suspect the people who made that argument knew as much. After all, housing covenants and other practices, but housing covenants above all, which forbid African Americans from moving into certain neighborhoods, effectively segregated schools, because where you go to school is pegged directly to where you live. So if African Americans could only live in a certain part of New York, a certain part of Boston, a certain part of Chicago,
or Milwaukee for that matter, right?
Yes. Sorry to not use a local example.
That's okay. I can.
So then effectively the only remedy to that is busing. And as we know from the 1974 Boston riots, there was incredible resistance from whites to busing.
And we're going to have to pause right there. Alexander Nazarian stays with us, senior writer at Newsweek. Getting your thoughts, Brown versus Board of Education, 800-642-1234. Where are we today? Back after this news. Linda Brown grew up to become an educational consultant and public speaker. Her obituary said that, thanks in part to her family's activism, her own children attended desegregated public schools. Linda Brown also credited her father for pushing forward with the case Brown versus Board of Education, but she later told NPR in an interview that she was proud of the role she played in the historic ruling. We're talking about this ruling, what it means for public schools today here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Alexander Nazarian stays with us. He's a senior writer at Newsweek, where he covers national affairs. His recent piece is titled, School Segregation in America is as Bad Today as It Was in the 1960s. Your thoughts on public education and this era after Brown at 800-642-1234. Did your school district integrate its schools when you were a child? Did you attend a very racially diverse school? Teachers and parents, do you see segregated education today? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Alexander, your title for your piece this week is quite provocative. Can you point to areas in the country as a whole that came close to Brown's goal of school integration?
Well, yes, of course, but not there. The problem is there aren't nearly as many such districts as there should be. I use the example of Charlotte, which was sort of the shining example of integration. It was the city that made school integration work, and it was celebrated for doing so, and that ended in it bused students across the county, Mecklenburg County, in a way that created racial balance, which is the way to foster school integration, because people continue to live in segregated neighborhoods more or less around the country, right? So the only way to make integrated schools work is to get people to agree to have their kids go to school not close to where they live, which is a very tricky thing to persuade people to, right, to do. So in Charlotte, they managed to do it, and people agreed to busing, and busing worked, and the schools worked, and integration worked, and Charlotte actually became a victim of its own success, because as it became celebrated as a jewel of the New South, it was the third biggest banking cap by the mid-80s, the third biggest banking city in the country after New York and San Francisco. It attracted people from the north and the west. It's a very nice place to live. And those people weren't familiar with the hard work that Charlotte had been doing for years in integration. And they bristled at having to bus their kids. And they moved to suburbs in the outlying parts of the county, where they wanted to attend their neighborhood schools, and they didn't want their kids bused closer into Charlotte Center. So they sued.
And this is in the 1990s when this lawsuit happened. Is that right?
Yes, and it was a lawsuit brought by a gentleman named Bill Cappuccioni, with whom I spoke for this article. He was from Southern California,
and he moved to the Charlotte suburbs, and he wanted his daughter, Christina, to attend a magnet school nearby, and she was denied admission twice, and he said that made her feel inferior, and he sued. Now, by this time, you know, Reagan had appointed hundreds and hundreds of federal judges in his term, and Bush had appointed, George H.W. Bush had appointed, not as many, but he had also appointed many conservative judges to the federal bench, and they were overturning these integration orders, and the judge in that case, Robert Potter, was in fact an opponent of integration, and he said, as many other judges were saying at the time, or had already said, that Charlotte had reached what is known as unitary status, meaning mm-hmm. that it had achieved integration. So the logic was, once you achieve integration, you no longer have to do integration. Now, that's sort of like saying, you are healthy, you no longer have to eat well. Go ahead and eat, bacon cheeseburgers for breakfast, because you, it seems like, all your blood work is good right now. And well, so what happens when you lift those integration orders? People just resegregate. Schools just resegregate. Integration is work, and this is the challenge. Integration is hard work that you have to keep doing. Once you stop doing it, all the good you've done goes away. And I think something that we need to talk about is that it is a social good. It's not just I think if we look at integration as some sort of moral imperative, which it is, of course, that's good and well, but it's also a social good. It's a benefit to society as a whole, because integrated schools are better schools, and disadvantaged children have better life outcomes.
And I think it's important to recognize, I think, too, that reaching unitary status, as you've been talking about, is not a relic of the past. There are still schools in America who are reaching unitary status designation. We moved from Louisiana, where there are schools all around us who are still going toward that unitary status designation. So this is not something that is decades removed.
No, you're absolutely right. This is, Brown v. Board, 1954 may seem like ancient history, especially in this day and age where news is so accelerated. But we are. If you have kids in a school district, it's very likely that they are living through some effect of Brown v. Board, whether there are kids being bused or whether there was a court order in place. The case is very much alive in the way that we think of public schools, in the way that we think of what public education even means, what that word public means, right? When we talk about neighborhood schools, we're talking about Brown v. Board. When we talk about magnet schools, we talk about Brown v. Board. It probably informs public education more than any other legal decisions that I could think of, or really of any piece of legislation. It's just so central to the way we understand ourselves as a society, frankly.
Leah tweeted at WPR Mornings, and she writes, "Real integration is never going to happen until reparations are made." Paul from Eau Claire emailed and said, "Millions of individual decisions by parents are organically segregating schools by race. Since this is happening organically, why should we impose top-down laws?" Alexander, what are the legal arguments for people today who are pushing back against school integration?
Their argument is essentially that school integration is social engineering. That's sort of what some folks on the right and frankly some jurists that's what they believe. In 2007, the Supreme Court ruled on a case called Parents Involved, which came out of Seattle and Louisville, where there was a, there was an objection to busing, and there's a famous line in the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, who was appointed, of course, by George W. Bush, where he says the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, and that's a very common argument, which says that integration is a form of discrimination because it selects people based on race, and we've said, according to this argument, that we don't want to base our decisions on race. So why are we right? So the redress to racism, according to people who believe this, is not more racial thinking. It's just to let it's to let people sort of do as they will, and not force them to bus kids or integrate schools in other ways. So that's the argument of people who are against integration. And there are of course fairly potent counter arguments to that. But I would say that since Parents Involved, the 2007 Supreme Court decision, that has generally been the thinking, that you can't use race as your primary integrative tool. So now you can do some integration today based on socioeconomic factors, which is the way some districts are doing it. But really, racial integration is sort of on the way out as something we're able to do in schools. That's just no longer really possible as a tactic. We're not going back to Jim Crow, but we're also not going back to the kind of integration that we saw in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, and you point out in the late 80s that nearly half of all African American children attended majority white schools. What was going on there?
Brown v. Board was working. There was all of those, and you know, when people talk about activist courts, when this, you know, this, you kind of have this, it's a favorite sort of, favorite conservative criticism, the activist court. Well, those activist courts were the federal judges who wrote those integration orders all over the country. And then the districts by the 70s, 80s were going to comply because the muscle of the federal government was now behind integration. So the courts essentially made sure integration worked. And of course there was great resistance, in Boston 1974, and of course elsewhere. But really, after I think Boston and the incredible resistance to busing from whites in South Boston, that was a real wake up call for many folks in terms of just how much resistance there would be from whites, and I think we learned a lot of lessons from that. And yet we continued to integrate. And after that, I think we did it more successfully. And although, Nixon and Reagan and many conservatives used forced busing as a wedge issue politically, it did continue to take place. And then by the 90s, there is a new movement to sort of undo that. And yes, that movement has essentially been successful. Busing is often the way the bus has been, and I write this in the piece, the bus is the primary tool of integration. So if the buses aren't moving, most likely that means integration isn't happening. And of course, the way to end that would be, the way to sort of work around would be to have people live together in neighborhoods that are integrated. How do you do that? That's an even more complicated question than school integration. I don't know what the answer is to that.
Newsweek senior writer Alexander Nazarian is with us. You can join this discussion, Brown versus Board of Education, 800-642-1234. Do you remember the Brown versus Board decision? How did you react to it? How did the people around you react? What were your thoughts today on racial integration? Where is schools separated? Where are they not? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Brian now, joining us from Fort Atkinson. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I remember when I was in, when 1976, I was in a class with someone who was black. I was integrated into a class myself, because I'm a totally blind person, and but I met my first blind, classmate in 1976.
How did teachers and administrators talk about school desegregation in the 1970s?
I think they were pretty cool with it. Well, at least the teacher that I had was pretty cool with it. She was, she said that it was a...
And you're blind, so you didn't exactly know who was white, who was black.
Was black. No, I didn't.
So how did that impact your schooling, and what about the relationships you made?
I have a black friend that lives in Chicago, and also had a roommate that was black.
Brian, thank you so much for the call. Alexander, at what point can affirmative action or integration be called racist from a legal point of view? Because it seems like there is a gray area, not necessarily about what's happening on the ground right now. It's more complicated, but trying to right the wrongs of history. Can the Supreme Court, recently upholding University of Texas's affirmative action policy, can the Supreme Court make up ground there, right the wrongs?
Well, I think your question is one that our society continues to struggle with, and in the Fisher case that you alluded to in the University of Texas, Abigail Fisher being a white woman who believed she was denied admission, there are people who argue that it is not the place of the courts to right those wrongs, and that is a large segment of the population that this is a form of social engineering and is undemocratic and antithetical to sort of notions of liberty on which this country is founded. There are others who believe, and I would put myself among them, that sort of social engineering is sort of government is fundamentally social engineering in many different ways, and as long as we can determine that quote engineering is not undemocratic and is sort of good and doesn't sort of infringe on people's liberties, then we ought to do it, right? There's no law that says you get to go to this particular neighborhood school, right? That's the government can say. It's within the right of government to say, we would like you to have your kid go to this school as opposed to this school, although, right?
And we're going to have to just break right there. Newsweek senior writer Alexander Nazarian stays with us on this conversation about Brown versus Board back after this news. Linda Brown was a third grader in 1951 when her father was among the plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. It led to the Supreme Court's 1954 landmark decision against school segregation. Linda Brown died this week. We're talking about her legacy and where school desegregation is at today here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Newsweek senior writer Alexander Nazarian is our guide. His recent piece is titled "School Segregation in America is as Bad Today as It Was in the 1960s. Does that seem provocative to you? Does that seem right on? Call in 800-642-1234. Parents and teachers, where do you stand on this issue? What are you seeing in your schools? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Sandy now, joining us from Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I went to high school in Madison in the early 70s, and it was a mostly white school, and they bused kids in from, when it started, and they bused black kids in from poor neighborhoods, and unfortunately, that caused a big have-not thing going on, and it really, to my mind, it needs to be the neighborhoods that are integrated so that the, so people could go to their neighborhood school.
So busing just isn't enough is what you found, Sandy.
Yep.
Sandy, yeah, thank you so much for that observation. Alexander, what do you make of that?
I think Sandy is absolutely correct. If she has a solution, she should, propose it to local lawmakers. And I'm not being flippant. She's absolutely correct. Unless neighborhoods are integrated into, we're never going to have a great fix. But unfortunately, there isn't a solution, not one that I've seen. Now, I urge anyone who's interested in this issue to read a book called The Color of the Law by Richard Rothstein. He's a University of California scholar who the book is about housing segregation. And it shows that housing segregation has a long-standing practice going back to the 1930s, and the way that the federal government made loans and allowed for essentially quite explicit segregation of communities. So, like Sandy said, busing is always going to be an imperfect solution, right? Because those kids, they come on buses. Everybody, they're looked upon as sort of being bused in. They have to go back on buses, so they can't go. They can't attend after school activities, perhaps evening activities, weekend, sporting activities. They're stigmatized. So that it's very unfortunate to hear Sandy's experience, and that experience has been replicated in many. It's all over the country, and continues to be where there is still busing. So, and she's absolutely correct, but I think unless we advocate somehow for integrated communities as a social good, and I keep coming back to that, not just as a moral good, which I think is actually, although it's a good argument, is just less potent, because I think if you make the case to Americans, look, this is good for us all. We will pay fewer taxes. If we integrate our schools, the people who go to those schools will have better life outcomes. We know this from research. And if they have better life outcomes, we're paying less for incarceration, for social welfare. They're contributing to society. They're paying taxes. So society just is sort of it's a rising tide lifts all boats argument. So I'd almost put aside the very obvious moral arguments of integration, and I'd make the more practical one. We tend to think of schooling as, what can the school do for my kid? Can my kid get into the University of Wisconsin or University of California, the Ivy League, whatever? Whereas I think we should be thinking of it, if I send my kid to this school and that other person sends their kid to a very bad school, I may end up paying for that down the road, right? You can look at we've known for decades that the social ills of the inner city, whether it's Milwaukee, Detroit, Los Angeles, Chicago, all of what we call the inner city there, all of those pathologies are tied to the schooling and to the inferior schooling that we're providing to children of color. And that continues to be the case. It was the case in the Johnson administration when this problem was sort of first addressed, and it's an issue now. And the question is, do we let that continue, or do we finally say there's going to be a fix? Now, I don't see any political will for there to be a fix right now.
Let's bring in David now in Appleton. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I wonder if your speaker's been in many schools. I, a substitute teacher in several districts and lots of schools, and I don't see the issue as being racial diversity. It's economic diversity. The apartments are clustered in all cities into certain zones, and those zones then tend to have more minorities, Hispanic, Asian, and African-American. So then those kids all feed into those schools, and which have very good teachers, but you've got many families that are low-income, single-parent households. Because they're single-parent households, they don't have necessarily parents at home for discipline, and that goes to the school, and you have got kids at schools that are behavioral problems, and that makes it difficult for the teachers to teach. So to me, it's not racial. It's an economic issue, and it's a family issue.
And economic issues then spiraling into so many, permeating into other areas. Is that right, David?
Correct. Yes, because these apartment complexes are inhabited mostly by single-family households, low-income, and those low-income apartments are going to attract Asians, Hispanics, African-Americans. So it's not that it's a racial issue, it's an economic issue and a family issue.
David, thank you so much for those observations. Alexander, I mean, he's circling back to this economic conversation that is permeating into so many facets of the educational system.
I think David I think his diagnosis is right on. I taught in the public schools in Brooklyn, New York, which is Brooklyn is an enormous city. It's I think 4 million residents, and what we had there was, I would see that in our schools, what David described very much, which is to say that wealthy children often had the resources to go to what were determined to be the best schools in New York City, whereas poor children, regardless of their color, were often relegated to lower tranches of education. So one thing, to go back to what Sandy said, if we could have mixed income housing and we could have mixed income communities, we would also have mixed income schools, which would be integrated schools. And that goes back to when we build when we build buildings, say in cities that are growing, that are like Madison, can we articulate sort of to people who are building, hey, you know, you can build this nice new apartment building, but make sure there are people here who are both well off and not so well off. And so if you can do that, that's one way to integrate schools that's not especially, I think, controversial, sort of mixed-income housing, having people live near people who make a lot more or a lot less than they do that could help solve the issue that we've been talking about.
And San Francisco Bay Area is one example of an area that's tried a bit more to be able to offer that, which grapples, of course, with cost of living big time, but trying to figure out how to bring different income levels into the same area, same neighborhoods.
It's very difficult, but I think now since parents involved the 2007 Supreme Court case, since we really can't use race anymore to integrate schools, we have to use income if we still want to do it. So Louisville is an example that I would use. That is still a district that does integration and does it well, and it does it through income. But income is so closely pegged to race that it essentially is the same thing. It's not a perfect correlation, but it's close enough that there are workarounds. And Louisville is often cited as the best example of that. Another example of a district that makes integration, both racial and socioeconomic, work is Hartford, Connecticut. And one of the ways it does that is through magnet schools. So magnet schools are often attractive to, let's say, upper-middle-class whites who live in the suburbs, but they also take kids from the inner city, and magnet schools sort of become a place where integration happens. Now, by no means are magnet schools perfect, nor are charter schools, which some people accuse of fostering segregation, but those are solutions. I hope I haven't been overly pessimistic. I do believe there are people working and thinking on this issue and wanting to get it right. There's just a lot of work to do.
Well, Alexander, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Alexander Nazarian is a senior writer at Newsweek, where he covers national affairs. His recent piece this week is titled, "School Segregation in America is as Bad Today as It Was in the 1960s. And we've been talking about the Brown versus Board of Education decision in light of the legacy that Linda Brown left as she passed away this week at age 75. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.